Let's have an AA meeting. My name's Tim, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting on NABA Zoom. Where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, we'll hear our speaker, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too, I must have this thing. And another one of them is Gary W., who will introduce our speaker.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Gary. I'm an alcoholic. It really is, it's a privilege for me to introduce our next speaker and, have a relationship with this individual as a sponsee, and a friend. Now we've been together for a couple of years and, it's the first month right now. I admitted I was powerless over alcohol in my life and became unmanageable. And that's when I decided to go back into the rooms and I knew I needed a sponsor. And I knew I needed a spiritual side in my life. I knew that. I knew that was missing. And I saw this person at the midway meeting, and he just really set the example of good principles and good spiritual sharing whenever I was in the meeting with them. And I thought, that's the guy that I'd really like to have be my sponsor. And so for 2 years now, going on January, this is my sponsor, Bob. And Bob, I'm really glad to have you here tonight and look forward to hearing you share. So here's Bob Jacobs.
Thank you, Gary. Good evening, everybody. My name is Bob, and I am an alcoholic. And when I say that, I have to also tell you that I am selfish, self-centered, egotistical, and arrogant. I am many, many things. I appreciate the opportunity that I was asked here to come and speak tonight, because there's nothing that I like more than an opportunity to talk about my favorite subject, which is me. Now, I heard this the other night. It's funny how God works in my life. I hear these things and I'm like, yeah. Somebody was talking about Will Rogers, and he said, Will Rogers had a saying that he always liked to hear a man talk about himself because he knew that he was going to hear nothing but good. Now, Will probably, that was 1918. Will was an alcoholic. He might have been, but he was never at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because what I'm going to tell you tonight, there's some good in here, but it ain't all so pretty. I was thinking, I could just come in here and throw up, and everybody just look at that and shake their head and go, me too, me too. That's how messy it gets. Kind of a funny aside here. I was thinking, in the promises it says we will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. So a few weeks ago, I'm asked to speak here, and the first thing I wanted is panic, and I'm worrying. Well, no, I intuitively knew, let go of that. Don't worry about it. When the time comes, God's going to handle it, so I let that go. That's kind of a profound intuition, but it works in my life in a simple way, too. Just the other day, I've got three dogs, and I stepped in a pile of dog crap, and I look down at my shoe. I can smell it, and I see it on my shoe, and I'm thinking, what do I do, And then something inside of my mind said, Bob, just take your shoe off, go over there, wash it out, scrape it out, put your shoe back on, you'll be just fine. See, because I normally wouldn't think of that kind of stuff. In my daily living, the way I used to live, hell, I'd have left that on my shoe. I'd have dragged it around. People have been seeing it on my shoes, smelling it on my shoe, and then they'd say, is that your shoe stinking? And I'd say, nope, because I'm a liar too. It's a mess. So I'm here to tell my story, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I kind of broke that down into the ABC of my A is surrender, my B is identification, and my C is reconciliation. This is how I see it. Anyway, I'll start with some beginning stuff. I came up born in a small town, southern Indiana, called Columbus, Indiana. Our claim to fame is we were the home of Cummins Engine Company. Diesel engines. They ran three huge plants, 24 days, 24/7, 365. The guys coming in and out of the plants. And very early on, I looked old enough. So I'm not going to talk too much about my childhood, but I looked old enough and I figured out if I went at the change of the guard at 7 a.m., I could slip in with the factory workers getting off of work and go in and buy my liquor. And so I was drinking from 15, 16, 17. I had a lot of fun drinking. I had, and I'm going to, spoiler alert here, drugs are part of my story. They're not a big part of my story, but they are part of it. So I will mention that somewhat. Mother and father were alcoholic. My mother was an admitted alcoholic. She had close to maybe 30 years when she sobered up, or when she passed away. She, sobered up through the program of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. My father was a doctor, and he was... This is just my consideration. He was a functional alcoholic and a drug addict. He used drugs. I think he was kind of like Dr. Paul in the Big Book. He managed his symptoms with drugs, but his drug of choice, was alcohol. So I come up in a home that's mother and father drink. Now, this is back in the day when people smoked. I'm not talking about just willy-nilly smoking. I mean really smoking. On every place you could sit an ashtray in the house, there was an ashtray, and it was usually full of cigarette butts. I never went to AA far enough back to where they, had to clean ashtrays out, as a service commitment in the AA meeting. But I sure as heck cleaned a lot of ashtrays out, in my mother and father's house, dumped them into the fireplace. Drinking, smoking, arguing, trouble. I am going to talk about my childhood a little bit. I don't blame what my parents did or how they acted on my alcoholism. I believe that, what I experienced as a young person, back then it seemed normal. I didn't know any better. Mom and dad drank, mom and dad smoked. Mama did it, daddy did it. So, I did it. And I enjoyed it. There was violence, abuse in my home, physical abuse, emotional abuse, spiritual abuse. It was pretty hardcore coming up. And I learned early on that drinking eased that pain, for some reason. One and one, definitely makes two there. So I started using alcohol and then later drugs, to help me get over that edge of what the hell was going on in my home. I didn't, understand, but I did know one thing. Alcohol took the edge off of that. Fortunately or unfortunately for me, when I was about 13, I was diagnosed with attention deficit disorder. They were wondering why I was acting out, why I was having these troubles, as a kid in school. And I was already crazy. What was going on inside of my home, was making me crazy. The things that I was starting to do, drinking, it was making me crazy. So they put me on Ritalin as a young man. That was a mistake, because what that did was set up a cycle for me that I would follow for the rest of my life. The Ritalin would get me very, up and high, and then the booze would bring me, back down. And I figured this out at 14 years old. So that set the stage for a roller coaster, what some people like to call the wash, spring, or repeat cycle. And I just kept doing it for many years. But again, my brother's doing it. My mother's doing it. All these people around me, the book is dead on. My alcoholic life seemed the only normal one. I knew nothing different. I didn't know any better. I didn't know any worse. All I knew is I felt bad on the inside. And when I did put these substances inside me, I felt different. I felt better. I felt okay. School, I guess I was a good student as a kid, but once drinking got introduced to me, it was really on. And I, fortunately or unfortunately, I remember my first real drink. I think I was 10 years old. We're sitting at the dining room table one evening, and my dad was a big gin drinker. And at dinner every night, my dad was the kind of guy that if there wasn't dinner on the table at 5 o'clock when he came home, there was going to be hell to pay, and mother was going to get it. And so it was always set up, always there. And he's sitting at the head of the table, and he's got a big tumbler of gin and ice and olives in it. He liked olives in his gin. And he sees me looking at it, and he says, "Huh, you want a taste of that?" And I'd had wine. I'd had a sip of beer, as a kid, but I'd never been drunk yet. And so I said, "Well, yeah, I'll have a sip of that." So I get it, and I take a sip, and he said, "No, keep drinking. No, keep drinking." So, I'm 10 years old, and I'm drinking this big tumbler of gin, and I got drunk. So I'm sitting there about 5 minutes, and he says, "Well, how do you feel about that?" And I said, "Well, I think I need to, go lie down." That set up another, stage for my drinking career in life. That's what I did. I'd get drunk, I'd go pass out, I'd wake up, round and around and around. The vicious cycle continued. So I barely make it through high school. My grades are terrible. I'm drinking, I'm partying, I'm running, I'm getting in trouble, but I'm still having fun. And I've got a friend, his name is Steve. Steve says, "Nobody ever told me that it's okay just not to drink. I didn't know that it was okay just not to drink." And so I'm drinking, and the people that I'm running with, they're drinking and partying and having fun. But in high school, I start to notice some of the people, moving on. And I was kind of stuck just where I was at, which, again, that was okay. I didn't know any better. I didn't know any worse. It just was what it was. And so I floundered around, for a few years, several years, until I decided I wanted to do something different. Now, this has nothing to do with drinking. I decided I wanted to go to college. So after barely graduating from high school, these years pass on, and my sister happened to be in college in Kentucky at the University of Kentucky, and they had a deal back then. If you had a family member who was getting in-state tuition, you could go and get in-state tuition too. And I thought, well, that's, what I want to do. And, same story there. I started out good, kind of a geographic change for me. My grades are good first year, and the drinking progresses again. I'm about 27 years old at this time. But I graduated. Best 7 years I ever had. I went to 4 years of school, and I fumbled through a couple years of graduate school until my drinking got me to the point where obviously I wasn't going to make it, in graduate school. So I got a job and got out in the world. I got married and started with the company that I'm with. And again, kind of a geographical I moved from Lexington, Kentucky to South Bend, Indiana. I'm newly married. And my wife, must have known there was some problem with my drinking, because I was always hiding bottles and, exceedingly drunk all the time. But we weren't married at that time. Now we're married. We've got an apartment. And it's kind of hard to hide bottles in a two-bedroom apartment when it's you and your wife and three dogs. And I'm drunk all the time. So at this point in my drinking career, obviously I have a problem. I should have seen that I had a problem, long, long before, but I already said it, That just seemed normal to me, the trouble, the hangovers, the wrecked cars, the ruined relationships, the accumulated damage that one builds up when they're drunk every day. But I started getting aggressive with my wife. Now, I have a tendency, I'm a pretty pretty nice, smooth, easygoing guy, but you get me drunk and you cross my path, especially if you're trying to get in the way of my drinking, there's going to be a problem. And I'm going to back you off. I will jump on you if I have to, but usually I'm big enough and I can speak well enough that I'll put you into a corner and I'll put you in your place and you'll just walk away and leave me alone so I can protect my drinking. So that's what starts happening between me and my wife. You know, she's telling me, you got a problem. You really need to stop that. And at this point, my mother had, you know, a few years of sobriety. And so my wife did to me the worst thing that a woman can do. She went to my mommy and she ratted me out that I got a drinking problem. And my mother snatched my butt up, you know, and twisted my ear, and she drugged me to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. This is many, many years ago, long before I finally got sober this time around. But her home group, she had a sponsor. Her sponsor's name was Phyllis, and, you know, great people, great home group. But my first meeting, it was kind of interesting, and I found out later that, you know, all groups do this when they say, you know, I always liked how it works, but then they get to the point in the readings where they say, are these extravagant promises? And then the whole group of them really loud goes, we think not. And I'm like, what the hell's going on here? You know, where am I? But I liked it. And I put the drink down for a while. And I had a few months of peace. I wasn't working the steps. I didn't have a sponsor. Didn't really have a home group. I just had my mother twisting my ear to go to meetings. And I had my wife on my butt because she was sick and tired of my, you know, being drunk all the time. And it started to work. And then I got a job change, moved with the company. And I knew I shouldn't be drinking. My life was improving, but I moved to Reno, Nevada, and I'm doing pretty good. New job. I've got something to focus on. I'm really driven. I'm motivated and I'm working this. And then I decide I can drink. The same, you know, what I find out, come to find out later on in my life is the lie. The same lie, it'll be different this time. You know, and that was really the first time I remember myself telling myself that. The big book says, you know, it's the thought that precedes the first drink. And as life went on, many years passed, you know, of trying to quit, starting again, trying to quit, starting again, or even being in the middle of drinking and being so sick and throwing up and swearing to God, you know, as I'm over the toilet, I won't do this again, Lord. By 5 o'clock in the afternoon, my car's on autopilot, and I'm saying, you know, it'll be different this time. It'll be different this time. Never was. So my stint in Nevada with the company goes pretty well. I didn't really control my drinking, but I'd been healed up long enough that it, you know, 4 years go past, and I did pretty good handling it. Moved to Shreveport, Louisiana, same deal, job transfer with the company, brand new facility to start up. I'm highly motivated. I'm driven. I get the people hired. I get everything put together, and but I'm still drinking. But at this point, my drinking is progressing to the point where, I, you know, I'm not feeling good. Families, you know, how sick I am, I'll share this. You know, when I'm drinking and I'm sick and I'm on a roll, when I walk in the house, even the dogs back up. You know, nobody wants to cross my path, my wife, my children. So I got to that point in Shreveport, Louisiana, and that was the first time I really admitted I needed help. I knew I couldn't stop. And I went into a treatment center. That was the first time I ever went into treatment. I've been in four inpatient treatments in 20 years and a couple outpatient, you know, just go in, get healed up, kind of come around the fellowship and the program, never got a sponsor, didn't work the steps, never got a home group, you know, all the things that everybody was telling me I should do, I didn't do because, you know, I thought I was different. You know, I can handle this on my own. There's a lot of things I can handle in my life on my own. I, you know, willpower, I have very strong will, but when it comes to alcohol, I'm powerless. But I couldn't admit that. So I come out of treatment that first time. You know, I stayed sober, I don't know, 4 or 5 months. And there's a story in the Big Book about the accountant that goes off to Washington, D.C., and his business comes off very well. Man, when I read that, that's my story. After, when I was in Shreveport, I was traveling for the company, and I flew out to Nevada. Business came off as usual. I dressed for dinner. I crossed the threshold into the room, you know, to have dinner, and a thought came into my mind that just one drink, you know. And then it was on again. That was a very terrible trip as well. On the way home, I got laid over in Dallas. I forget which airport it was, but I had to spend the night there. And I got so sick. And the next day, I'm getting on this airplane, and I just feel terrible. And I maybe stayed sober a couple of weeks after that. But, you know, almost a typical story runs right along with what that guy said. You know, he finds himself, somebody picks him up at the airport instead of his wife. You know, he spends a couple of weeks going around just sick and crazy. It never worked out. But luckily for me, in Shreveport, got another job transfer. Here comes the opportunity for another geographic. I can see it for what it was today because I've learned, you know, from the fellowship, from the people. The geographic changes did work for me for a while. I moved to Midway, Georgia. Again, I'm very motivated. I'm very driven. I've got something to focus on. The job takes my attention, and I boom, boom, boom. I get things set up. As soon as it's all set up again, I can drink again. And so I start again. Funny story, I was sober when I got here. This is 16 years ago. And I talked to a friend of mine that I went to high school with. His name is Greg. And Greg never quit drinking. But he and I talk, you know, every once in a while. So Greg gives me a call and we're talking, and he's talking about his drinking. And the thought came into my mind, this is how crazy I am. If Greg's doing that, hell, I should be able to do that. Now, this is after having gotten in trouble, you know, with my wife. My mother drags me to AA. I've been in and out of treatment, in jail, in trouble, knowing all of this stuff. But I thought it would be different this time. So off to the races again, you know, my same routine. Jump forward a little bit. It crashes, it burns, it always does. And I ended up in treatment the very last time. And it hit me. It was in, the treatment center was kind of full. So for the first 3 days, they put me in the insane ward with the people who were really insane because they didn't have a bed for me, but they knew I needed to be locked up. So I had a very nice visit, you know, and stayed in there for 3 days. With people who really, you know, I think I have problems. I got no problems. My God. I was in there for 3 days with people that they really have problems. You know, my problem is I'm an alcoholic. So anyway, after night three, I'm walking the halls. I finally get into the detox ward with the people, and I'm still sweating it out 3 days later, and a thought came to my mind. And that thought was, if I drink again, it will never be different. It will never be different. And that was an epiphany. I had never thought that. That was something new. And so I became determined that I was going to do whatever it took this time, you know, to go through with it. They pumped me full of meetings again and treatment this time. They made me sign an agreement this time that I would, as soon as I got out, I would go to a meeting that night. The first time, you know, they said, as soon as that meeting's over, you raise your hand. You say, my name is Bob and I am an alcoholic and I need a sponsor. Because I'd never, you know, in 20 years in and out of the rooms, I had one sponsor, you know, that I kind of just asked because they made me get it. You know, I had to have a paper signed that I had a sponsor. Didn't take advantage of them. So this time around I come out, I'm determined. I guess the word here is I'm surrendered. I'm surrendered to the fact that if I do it again, it's going to be the same and I need to do something different. And so I raised my hand at the end of that first AA meeting, and a nice man named Pat, and I still know Pat, became my first sponsor. He said, you know, I'll be your temporary sponsor for a while. But so Pat spends some time with me, and we talk, and I start to become open to listen, and then now we get into identification. I started identifying with somebody who had the same problem I had and had taken some certain steps and done some things to change that. Because I'm still sick. You know, I come out of treatment, you know, it's maybe 2 months. I'm still sick and I still want to take a drink. And I'm wondering if I haven't overthought this too much, you know, that maybe I can pull it off again. But I keep going back to that night, sweating it out in that hallway, and it's saying it will never be different. I'd stopped. It always ended up in the same place, you know, crash and burn. So I stick with it. I started going to some other meetings. They said, you know, don't just go to one meeting. Go to a lot of meetings. Be looking for a home group. I said, how will I know it's my home group? And this guy, his name was Mike. He was in the treatment center. He said, Bob, go to as many different meetings as you can. And he said, one day you're going to walk into a place and you're going to take a deep breath and you're going to go, I feel okay here. So I'm going to a lot of different meetings, and I find my home group. It's the Midway group. I have a lot of people who are here this evening with us who are from my home group. My good friend Betty was there when I came in. You know, it was a Saturday morning. I needed a meeting. I'm looking at the meeting schedule, and this Midway Methodist Church, you know, it's only like 5 minutes from where I work. And I said, you know, ma'am, I need to get to a meeting or I'm going to drink today. And so I go in there, and I knew what Mike was talking about. I sat down. Betty, Joe, maybe Steve was there, Jimmy Ray, you know, the people who were there when I came in. And I just felt at home, and very quickly made that one my home group. Then I met my sponsor. My sponsor's name is Terry. Terry's an American Indian. Terry doesn't believe in the white man's God. Terry's got his own relationship, but there was just something about Terry that I liked. You know, Terry had long-term sobriety. When he walked into the room, you could see it in his eyes. You could see the way the man carried himself, and I wanted what Terry had. And through a series of events, you know, Terry became my sponsor. And I finally came right out to him one time, and I said, Terry, I want what you have. And it's not the money, it's not the clothes, it's not, you know, any of those material things. It was just the peace of mind that I could see in that man's face, that he could look people in the eye, that he could speak clearly. You know, I couldn't do these things when I came in, you know, almost 8 years ago now. And Terry says to me in typical sponsor fashion, he says, Bob, if you want what I have, you're going to have to do what I've done. So I spent a lot of time with Terry for like 2.5-3 years. Terry and I had lunch or late breakfast Sunday mornings. Terry took me through the big book, which I had read many times, but I never, you know, did the work. Terry took me through the steps, which I'd read on the wall many times, but I never did the work. And it changed and it saved my life. I remember when the obsession to take a drink left me. It was after I did my fourth step. Terry and I get together, did my fifth step, sixth step. And, you know, some people, the book says, you know, go away for an hour, do the seventh step. But Terry and I did it together because that's what Terry did with his sponsor. And, my God, when we got through that, the obsession didn't leave. It was gone. It left me that day, and it hasn't come back. You know, the book is spot on, you know, except for a few occasions, you know, when the thought comes. And I think that happens for all of us. I know it does for me. But every time the thought comes to my head, you know, that drink would be nice, I go back to that moment when I had the epiphany in the hallway, sweating it out that last time in treatment. It'll never be different. The tape plays forward for me just that quick. I know exactly where it will take me. And so in the last time through treatment and getting a sponsor and getting a home group and working the steps, I've developed today, and I'm just talking about me, a program that was passed on to me and a way of living that was passed on to me, but I've developed myself. It's somewhat, you know, it's a group fellowship, but it, for me, it's become somewhat of an individual journey that I get the opportunity from time to time to share with people, and I call it the recipe. The recipe. This is a recipe. The Big Book to me is a cookbook. It's a recipe that if I will do these things in this order to the best of my ability, I will achieve a certain result. It may not be your result. It may not be his result, their result, the first 100 result. All I know is that when I put the recipe into effect, I have seen a miracle happen. And that miracle is I'm sober today. I am sober today. For somebody who drank and drugged like I did for as long as I did, the fact that I am sober today is a miracle. And it came about by following the recipe that was, you know, provided to me by the Big Book, the program, the fellowship. And it's, for me, it's a pretty simple recipe. They told me in treatment this last time when I was listening, he said, Bob, you know, before you go to bed at night, why don't you just get on your knees and say a prayer? And he said, while you're down there, stick your shoes underneath your bed. And in the morning, you're going to have to get up and you're going to have to get your shoes up from out from underneath the bed. And he said, while you're down there on your knees digging your shoes out, why don't you say, God, you know, help me stay sober tonight or today. And so I started that. Very simple. I keep it simple. I talked to my friend Gary, you know, and I'm always saying, is it just that simple, Gary? Is it just that simple? It's just as simple as this. Now, this is just a simple, you know, blue poker chip. It means I got 1 year. I've got a nice big fancy, you know, 7-year medallion that was given to me, and I love that. I keep it. But in my pocket, you know, I carry this very simple blue chip every day to help remind me that I'm an alcoholic. And I will always be an alcoholic, and if I drink again, it will never change. Also, and many of you have heard this one, Betty likes to say, she says, and if you think like you want to drink, stick that in your mouth, and when it dissolves, you can have one. I haven't gotten that far yet, but I carry it in my pocket just in case, because I never want to take another drink of liquor again as long as I live. So the recipe, prayer, I pray. In the morning, I pray at night. They also said, you know, do your daily reflection, the AA simple daily reflection book. You know, I've been reading it day after day, year after year, and it's still new every single day. I do that every single day. It's grown over time. I've incorporated through reading Dr. Bob and the good old timers. Dr. Bob, you know, was a Methodist. He read The Upper Room. The Upper Room is a Methodist devotional, and I was like, the first time I read this, and this is probably 5 years ago, I was like, huh, well, if Dr. Bob did that, you know, that's good enough for me. I'm going to start doing that too. And sure enough, you know, I bring in another piece of the recipe, something spiritual, you know, a daily devotional. I'm a Christian person, you know, reading the Bible, reading the approved literature. Staying active, doing something. This one brings me to another little quip I like. I was in a meeting probably 2 years sober, and a guy's sitting across the table from me, and I forget who it was. It might even been Terry B or somebody, and he looked at me and he said, Bob, if you just do something different, you'd get a different result. Now, I'm 2 years sober. And he might as well take a baseball bat and cracked me right between the eyes with it, because that was another epiphany. What? I almost said, could you repeat what you just said? If you do something different, you'll get a different result. Because I, you know, that's the definition of insanity. Most of us here already know that. You know, I continue to do the same thing over and over and over again, expecting it to be different. And the truth is, you know, it won't. It can't. I mean, if time after time, in and out of trouble, and I like the other one, people say, you know, I didn't get in trouble. every time I was drinking, but every time I got in trouble, I'd been drinking. You know, that's my story. That's my story. But I wasn't capable of putting all that together on my own. I needed the fellowship. With my sponsor, Terry, I'd kind of whine because I'd been in and out of the rooms for 20 years trying to get sober. And I'd say, Terry, you know, why did it take me so long? And he said, well, Bob, Terry's a smoker. He usually has a cigarette in his hand. He'd say, well, Bob, it takes what it takes. And then one day he looked at me right in the eye and he said, you weren't ready yet. You weren't ready. When the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And so I'm still ready. I still follow the same simple recipe. You know, don't drink, go to meetings, get a sponsor, service, service, service. This is last little side story here, I'll tell you. My friend Steve, his name is Steve B. Steve probably saved my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. There have been a lot of things that have happened that have changed my life, but I swear Steve saved my life this night. I'm, again, about 2 years sober, really not knowing what I want to do. I was the kind of guy that I'd come to a meeting late. I'd slip inside of the room. I'd find my chair, maybe get a cup of coffee. And as soon as, you know, the Our Father's over, I'm already up against the wall. I'm working my way around the room, and I'm out the door before anybody can talk to me, before anybody can have any interaction with me, you know, because I'm not sure about this yet. So this night, the night my life was saved, I don't know if I was going to get drunk that night, you know, who knows. But God put Steve Berg in front of me that night. As soon as I'm ready to make my escape right around the corner and get to my car and get out of there, there appears Steve right in my face, and he says, hi, my name is Steve, you know, I've seen you around. He said, we're having a group conscience meeting tonight. Have you ever been to a group conscience meeting? And I'm like, no, I've never been to a group conscience meeting, Steve. And he said, well, you know, why don't you, because I was smoking back then. He said, go outside, smoke your cigarette, take about 5 minutes, you know, come back in. And he said, maybe you'll learn something, you know, by attending this group conscience meeting tonight. And so I did. And I came back in and I was hooked, you know, in service. Again, I was with my home group. They were my home group, but I'd never been to a group conscience meeting with them. And I got to sit there and be part of something, part of something. The book talks about the loneliness that only an alcoholic knows. I can be in a room full of people, you know, water, water everywhere, not a drop to drink. I can be in a room full of people and be completely alone and isolated in here. But that night, when I was at that group conscience meeting, I became and felt part of something, which I hadn't felt for a long, long time. It reminds me of, like, in the Star Wars movie when Darth Vader is in the Death Star and he stops, looks up, kind of looks around and says, I feel a presence that I haven't felt in a very long time. I felt something that night that I had not felt in a very long time, and that was part of something. You know, I'm married. I had a family. I didn't feel part of it. I felt alone and isolated. And this is another quip. You know, you people loved me until I could learn to love myself again. I didn't really know how to love anything. And I wasn't part of anything until I got in that home group. And today I'm part of something. I was never a joiner, you know, because I think I'm so damn smart. You know, nothing good enough for me. Today I know that if I don't remain part of this fellowship, if I don't remain part in service, I'll drink again. And I don't ever want to take another drink of liquor as long as I live. So being part of this, following the recipe, you know, going to meetings, still communicating, service. I have a service position that, like many people, they ended up making me. Our GSR, his name is Jimmy Ray, and Jimmy Ray passed away. So we had to come to a quick decision one afternoon, and I ended up being a GSR. I stayed GSR for, I don't know, 3 years, something like that, 4 years maybe. And we ended up getting another GSR, and I took another service position. I'm the PI, PCP, rep for our group, but service and being part of and being active really saved my life. I want to hit the last one, reconciliation. Through the process of making my amends, for better, for worse, as good as they were, as bad as they were, as many as I've made, and as few as I've made, I have become reconciled to a few things. One, that I am an alcoholic, and if I drink again, it'll never be the same. I've also become reconciled with my childhood and the pain and the, you know, the suffering that I went through. I know I'm getting kind of close to the end, and I'll try to wrap it up with this one. My father and I didn't have a very good relationship at all. In fact, it was downright vicious, violent, and mean. My father taught me how to drink. He taught me how to smoke. He taught me how to fight. He taught me how to run women. And those were the best things my father ever taught me. But coming up, you know, he beat me a lot. There was a lot of problems in the house, and I hated my father. I hated him. You know, as much as I enjoyed going drinking and fishing and shooting and hunting and all the things that he and I did together, at some level I was mad at him because he beat me as a child. Not only did he do that to me, he did that to my brother. My brother was a heroin addict. He died with a needle in his arm about 7 years ago. And when my brother died, I stopped speaking to my father because I blamed my brother's death on my father. You know, that what my dad had done, and the way my brother lived his life, and the way my brother had to treat his pain, you know, through drugs and alcohol, I blame my dad. And, you know, the truth is, and this is where the reconciliation comes, it was nobody's fault. It is what it is. And I can either, you know, live in the pit, or I can get out of the pit and shake it off of me, but there's not a damn thing I can do to change the past. And if I didn't get over all that pain from my past, I wasn't going to have much of a future either. So I'm still not speaking to my father. This is 4 years ago now. And my sister calls me. I knew my dad wasn't doing well. And I knew he was in hospice. But I still, you know, and this is 3 years sober, I still couldn't bring myself to talk to him because I was mad. And my sister said, Bob, you know, Dad's about to pass away. He's, you know, he can hear you, but he can't speak. She said, if you have anything to say to him, you know, there's your shot, man. You better take it. So they put the cell phone up to his ear. And the only thing that I could say was, Dad, I know this is a hell of a time to tell you I'm sorry, but I'm sorry. And I love you. And I'll see you on the other side. And those were the last words I ever spoke to my father. I'm told, you know, it wasn't many minutes after that he passed on. And so I'm reconciled to that. The reconciliation of these many things in my life relieves a lot of pain. The preparing and then giving the fifth, you know, preparing through four step, giving my fifth step, sharing with my sponsor relieved a lot of pain and took a lot of the excess baggage out of me that I'd been carrying around for years. Uniquely, as I follow the path that I'm on today, working the recipe, sharing, you know, speaking, taking these opportunities to be open, to be part of something, I'm relieved of those pains that would possibly cause me to become in so much pain that I might take a drink. And it works, and it's been working for me, and I'm going to continue doing it. This is a lifetime journey. You know, the big book, the big book, the big book. My sponsor, Terry, again, you know, he'd hold the book up and he'd say, Bob, the answer to every one of your problems today is in this book. How much time are you spending in this book? You know, what are you doing with the book? And so I started really focusing on the book. Gary or Terry was somewhat of a thumper, and I never liked that, but today, you know, I say it too. How much time are you spending in the literature? How much time are you reading the book? Are you talking to, you know, your sponsor about these things? Are you sharing about it? And I'm preaching to the choir. It's life-changing. It's miraculous. And it's just as simple as, I didn't take a drink today. You know, is it just that simple? There's another book, Dr. Paul wrote it. It's called There's More to Quitting Drinking Than Quitting Drinking. As we all know, alcohol was just a symptom of my disease. You take away the alcohol and I'm left with me. But what you people did was you helped me, you know, come to love me again and understand that I'm not so different. I'm not so unique. And that if I'll take a deep breath, if I'll keep doing these things, you know, following what I call the recipe, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. And today, you know, family, I will take okay because I know what it's like not to be okay and to be powerless over it and not to be able to do anything about it myself. And that's the secret. I never will be able to do anything about, you know, anything by myself. I need you. And for those of you who don't know this, we need each other. We can't do it alone. I always thought I was so smart, so strong, so capable that I could just do it all on my own. And that was a lie, another lie that my mind would tell me and I would believe. I thank you all for this opportunity to come and be with you, to share with you. Hopefully something that came out of my mouth this evening, you know, you identified with, and maybe it'll make some change. Maybe it won't. But I know today, just thinking about that I had to do this tonight kept me sober one more day. And for that, I thank you.
Thank you, Bob. And I think I speak for everybody. We needed that. We needed you tonight. You delivered. That was real AA. We really appreciate you. And love and service, it sure makes sobriety a lot more fun. Makes it strong. Thanks for sharing.
I'm Patty. I'm alcoholic still. Bob, thank you so much. That was a great story, and I love your recipe, and really helped me to hear it tonight. Thank you so much. Glad you're here.
Hey, Bob. I'm Marianne. I'm an alcoholic, and that was just a great story. I can see why Gary gravitated towards you because of, you know, he too struggled coming in and out. And, you know, I've been aiming on my higher bottom or whatever, so it's so good for me to hear your story. How many times did you, you know, that you tried to do it by yourself? And to know, obviously, again, that it's a we program, and that's what it's all about. And it is easy in terms of picking up that first drink. That's all that's required of us, is that we not pick up that first drink. So thank you for reminding me that.
I'm Betty, I'm alcoholic.
Hey, Betty.
Thanks, Bob. Bob, you never disappoint. You know, I remember that door dodger. When he first came to Midway Maintenance, he did it. He got up and he kind of scooted like in a cartoon, you know, like you'd look and he'd be here, you'd look and he'd be here. And, you know, eventually he was out the door of all persons to stop him. Steve is good at that. Or Steve. He does that. And, you know, I've watched Bob grow since when he first came into us at Midway, and my goodness, the spiritual side of my recovery always needed work, extra help. And before Bob came, his sponsor, Terry, helped me through a lot of that. And then Bob came with his spirituality, and, you know, he didn't get religious-y. Well, that's not a word, is it? He didn't spew religion. He discussed his spiritual side. I was able to get an awful lot from him. Things I needed, and I still do. And I'm very proud of the growth and the man he's become. I know his wife. She's good people. I've seen his kids grow over the last few years. You know, they come to his celebrations now instead of avoiding. You know, those are the promises that we get when we keep doing day by day. And for myself, every day isn't perfect by a long shot. But, you know, every day that I make that conscious decision not to drink, with the help of my higher power, is a day of freedom for me. It's a day of growth. No matter how old I get, I'm going to keep growing. You people taught me how to have an open mind. And for that, I'm grateful.
I'm gone away. I ain't never going back. Only thing I own in a paper sack. I'm all alone, and I'm lonesome day and night. I need someone's hand carry me when I'm tired. I can't stay here no more. That mean old bartender just showed me the door. Somewhere, somehow, I'll win my fight someday, and we'll all be together on that broad highway. On that broad highway.